Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I am Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Douglas Manuel.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask about their latest book.
What was difficult and what was easy about writing it.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
If you want to hear more about the writers we interview and work with them in person, you can attend a live reading and workshop with them at the Poetry Salon.
Find out more and register for great workshops and events with us and our favorite poets at www.thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
Hello, Poetry Salon listeners. Welcome to the Poetry Salon. Today, we will be talking with the poet Kai Coggan. Kai Coggan is the author of Mining for Stardust from Flower Song Press 2021, Incandescent, Sibling Rivalry Press 2019, Wingspan, Golden Dragonfly Press 2016, and Periscope Heart, Swimming with Elephants Publication 2014, as well as a spoken word album, Silhouette 2017. She is a queer woman of color who thinks Black Lives Matter, a teaching artist in poetry with the Arkansas Arts Council, and the host of the longest running consecutive weekly open mic series in the country, Wednesday Night Poetry. Recently awarded the 2021 Governor's Arts Award and named Best Poet in Arkansas by the Arkansas Times, her fierce and powerful poetry has been nominated 4 times for the Pushcart Prize, as well as Bettering American Poetry 2015. And Best of the Net 2016 and 2018. Her poems have appeared or are forthcoming in Poetry, Cultural Weekly, Solstice, among others. Coggan is associate editor at the Rise Up Review. She lives with her wife and their 2 adorable dogs in the valley of a small mountain in Hot Springs National Park, Arkansas. Kai, welcome to the podcast. It is such a pleasure to get to meet you after reading all of your poetry. I have to tell you, I've been really looking forward to this because your most recent book, Mining for Stardust, which I sat down to read yesterday, just feels so relevant, so prescient. So thank you very much for being here. All right, that's enough of that, Michigoth. Okay, whenever you feel ready, just dive in.
Okay. I'm going to start with a poem that was difficult for me to write. It was when we crossed the 100,000 mark of COVID deaths here in America, and it was Memorial Day weekend. And so this poem is called Makeshift Memorial. We crossed over the 100,000 mark like it was just another Tuesday. No fanfare, no flourish of flowers left on 100,000 graves. Funeral-less limbo walkers who disappear like a fog into the history we are writing with our collective inadequacy to be decent to each other. A memorial is an object which serves as a purpose and a focus for the memory or the commemoration of something, usually an influential deceased person or a historical tragic event. From behind a mask, I whisper 100,000 names on the day we call memorial. Because something should be done to remember the living as they slip away. The uptick in numbers that were never just numbers, but bodies full of breath, full of breath, full of breath, full of breath. Knees and arms, ankles and bellies, cheeks that dimpled at smiles, gaps in teeth, snores when she sleeps, feet that once learned to tango. Earlobes once kissed in moonlight, curls of hair silken to white, his aching back that worked so hard in the field, her childbearing hips, leaving children behind, hands and hands and hands that reach for mine in my mind. Not just numbers, but human beings, reduced, reduced. Reduced until the only common denominator is how quickly they are forgotten in this pandemic pandemonium. I can't sit with that. No, not today. On Memorial Day, we remember those who fought for our country and died, but half the country forgot those fighting in ICU beds just to stay alive. The collective death toll of our last four wars, and half of the country doesn't want to quarantine anymore. 100,000 dead, while America throws pool parties, beaches and boardwalks swarm with shoulder-to-shoulder crowds who dismiss the safety of the future for the party of now. Because this is America, land of the free, and don't tread on me, and nobody's going to tell me to wear a mask. And all of those soldiers who died in all of those wars, I guess America can tell them it's too much to ask to protect one another and help slow the spread. So happy Memorial Day, 100,000 dead, a mass grave of indifference. Red-capped rebels drinking their bleach cocktails, and they are here, banging on the door of my reverence to the lost, waving their AR-15s on the Capitol steps of this poem, and I breathe them out. And I breathe them out, and I breathe them out. I build a makeshift memorial in my heart for the lives we have lost. Photos and teddy bears and scraps of poems. I light 100,000 candles in the pit of my rib cage so that when I speak, only the light of them releases into the dark night of this country. I dance with their 100,000 ghosts. I lay their favorite flowers at all of their perfect feet. In the language of heart, I know their favorite flowers. And I lay a bright "She Loves Me" petal on each of their lips so they can breathe easy the ethers of beauty while they rise into becoming anew. We have to give them that grace, even just a thought, a well wish into the stars. We have to give them that grace. Tomorrow in America, a new story named George will take our focus, will move us into fury or collapse us into numbness. But today, I am a makeshift memorial, a mouth full of epitaphs, a funeral pyre burning the sound of 100,000 names into the history of a country too quick to forget. The next day, George Floyd was murdered by the hands of police, as we all know, and it really took the focus off of that mile marker, that number, that 100,000 that seems so small now, looking back as we are kind of deja vuing into all of this again. And I live in Arkansas, where only 36% of the population here is vaccinated. I don't know, it was such a hard poem to write because weighing all of those different factors of being in a red state and being so progressive and being a blue flame of truth and beauty. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that. The poem that was the easiest for me to write and the poem that filled me with so much joy was the first poem that I wrote for Joanne, my wife. And it was the first time I got to call her my wife in a poem. We got married during the pandemic, during COVID, on Zoom, in our backyard. And we've been together for 13 years. And finally, being able to call her my wife in a poem is still just the most beautiful and easiest thing for me to do. So this poem was published in Poetry Magazine. And it's called "Filling Spice Jars as Your Wife." It seems like all my poems after this will be different. They will hold a different weight, like how the weight of my heart has shifted into indistinguishable float, into lifting cloud, into weightless flight tonight as the rain gently falls on the summer heated tin roof, the din of casual raindrops and warm low lights glowing and wind blowing through the house. We have all our doors and windows open. We have all our doors and windows open, and I am pouring spices into glass jars, coriander, cinnamon, cumin, ground sage, and it's hard to describe this moment in the confines of a page. Tiny hills of vibrant color and intoxicating fragrance, and you hear the cadence of my heart from the kitchen where you build perfect fitting slip-in shelves for our spices over the stove. Match the colors, match my colors to yours. I have all my doors and windows open to you. I have all my doors and windows open to you, and you have come all the way inside, sat down at the table of my deepest desires, and lit a fire to warm us both. The wind blowing through the house, the rain gently giving way to turmeric sunrise, and you, darling, you are my wife. You are my wife. And it's like I have been waiting my whole life to say those words, and I feel held in a way I have never felt before, to look down at my fingers, dusted with ginger and thyme, and see the gold of my wedding band glint and shine in the warm, low-light glow. I am yours, and you are mine. Promised on Zoom in our garden of giant zinnia and hummingbird vines, sung out in the morning song of bluebirds, this union that ripples love out to the world and infinities back into us again, love. In the fine powder of these spices, ground up essence of oregano and basil, I see our love in every atom suddenly, and every cell in me finally exhales. And perhaps that is the wind. Perhaps that is the wind blowing through the house, this release of eternal searching and finding you there, calling me your forever, naming me your always, to have and to hold, till death do we part and start all over again, looking only for each other's hearts, taking my life in your hands eternal, marrying me to the heavens, latching me to the star trail of your white dress in this orbital dance, this lift and spin, this knowing from within that all my poems after this will be different because you are my wife. So that one definitely was a lot easier for me to write, and it was just literally the next day, we got a bunch of spices as a wedding gift, and she was building us a shelf, and I was pouring those spices into the glass jars. You know, those moments where you're like, this is a poem unfolding right now, these colors, these smells, these scents, and her in the kitchen. And that was this poem where I finally got to call her my wife. And this book definitely is a mixture of what we have been through, but finding light. Mining for stardust, that's what this title means. There was so much darkness, but I tried my best, as I always do, to find the stars, to find the glow, to find the light and beauty, and write about it.
Before we get into your book, though, I would love it if you would just tell us a tiny bit about how you got started writing as a poet.
Well, first, thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be a part of the Poetry Salon and just to meet you two face to face. But I was started writing poetry when I was younger as a means for survival. Honestly, I went through a lot of trauma and didn't really have anywhere to put those feelings and those experiences. Angst and teenage love and questioning my sexuality and not being able to come out and be my true self and all of these feelings as a young person, being raped. I put those in a book and I just kind of kept those feelings, those poems to myself, but it was kind of like I didn't have to carry the weight of those experiences anymore if I could just write them down. And so poetry for a long time was my best friend. It was my lifesaver. I could put my secrets there. I could put my feelings there. And so I held on to that and I went to Texas A&M University. I joined the Corps of Cadets at Texas A&M because I wanted to be like my father, and he was a Marine and all that stuff. But I was a very out, coming into my sexuality, young, free-spirited person at like 18. And then I went to the Corps of Cadets, which is a very right-wing, fundamentalist, absolutely opposite of everything I was organization. And I was gay. And it was still around the time of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and all of those things. And so now that I'm a grown woman and can look back on my life, it's almost like I put myself in these situations to really fight it out with these different painful things in order to process them and write about them and then help people through these different situations if they have to go through them. So going back to with Sandra Cisneros, To make a long story short, I was kicked out of the Corps of Cadets my junior year for fraternizing with a woman. I was expelled. I had to do, you know, marching tours. And I dropped my major and switched over to poetry when I got out of the Corps. And it was really one professor there in college that just gave me a little bit of inspiration. He's like, you've got something special. He could tell that I was different. He could tell that I had something. And a lot of times it just takes that one teacher, that one professor to see, hey, don't give up on this. You're good at that. You know, so I took that and it was a saving grace for me. When I graduated with a degree in poetry, I was like, well, what the hell do I do now with a degree in poetry? So I did what a lot of us do. And I went into teaching and I started teaching 9th and 10th grade English. And as a first year teacher, they gave me the bad kids, quote unquote, because that's what they do to first year teachers, the rough kids. And I was one of those rough kids when I was growing up. I went back to the same school district, so I could totally understand where they were coming from, how to talk to them, how to reach them. And when we finally got to the poetry unit, I wanted to do something special. I didn't want to bring in the old dead white guys canon because it wasn't going to reach my 98% Black and Hispanic kids. You know, they didn't care about Walt Whitman. They didn't even have a garage, or they didn't even know what skiing was. So I brought in Sandra Cisneros, The House on Mango Street. I brought in the poem Loose Woman. It's a great poem that confronts all the stereotypes that she was given when she was growing up. People called her a lesbian. They called her a witch. They called her all of these things. And she writes about it in this one poem. I put it on the overhead and we went through it really slowly. And they could see the word bitch there on the screen, on the overhead. So they're like, ooh, miss, oh my God. So right away, you have a little hook, you know. They really loved the poem. They really got into it. And then I wanted them to write a shadow version of that poem. So what are some stereotypes that people put on you? Like, oh, you're a 15-year-old Mexican girl, you're probably going to be pregnant next year. Oh, you're a 17-year-old Black boy, you're going to either be dead or in prison. You know, the different stereotypes that are given to them. They didn't get their own individuality. They were grouped into what society thinks of them. So this situation really gave them the agency and the permission to look at those stereotypes, to name them and actually write them down and see them concretely. But that poem gives the permission to flip all that on its head. Loose Woman flips all of those stereotypes on their head. So they did the same thing. And it empowered them to name themselves, to name their own individuality, what makes them special, what really makes them me, a person. So the next unit was persuasive writing. And I was the kind of teacher that's rolled with the energy of the classroom. I didn't write my lesson plans. I just felt them that day. So how could I use persuasive writing but keep this level of engagement? My kids wrote persuasive letters to Sandra Cisneros, convincing her or asking her to come to our school to read that poem to us. And I found the address of her agent in New York City. They had these, they're awesome poems. They typed them all up. And then on the back of that, they typed up their persuasive letters. I got pretty fountain pens and they practiced writing their signatures and stuff. And so they signed them all fancy. I wrote a letter as well. And we had 200 poems, 200 letters. And it was Christmas vacation and patting myself on the back. Good job, Miss Coggin, you young whippersnapper of a teacher, you stirring things up. And I was just happy to make it to Christmas break. And I thought that that would be it, the end of that whole lesson. And when I came back after Christmas, there was an email from Sandra Cisneros in my email box. And she said, yes, I would like to come and meet your students. What happened was her agent received that box of letters in New York, read a couple of them, got on a plane to San Antonio and knocked on Sandra's door and said, here, you've got to read these. Sandra had just lost her mother. Her mother had just died. And so she was in this sort of tailspin of grief and devastation, and she wasn't writing anymore. And then all of a sudden she gets this box of letters and poems from kids that were just like her, kids in Houston, in the hood that, you know, like, hey man, your poem saved my life. Your poem gave me a way to think about my life differently. And it was just such a burst of inspiration and light that she needed. And so it was this sort of reciprocal exchange of what she did for my kids and then what my kids did for her. She came to the school. We had a whole day of poetry readings. The kids wore their Sunday best clothes. They brought food from their different cultures. And it was like an event. And she autographed 200 of her brand new hardcover books for each of those kids. She waited in line, talked to all of them. And for most of them, it was the first time that they owned a hard copy book that they could say, this is my book. They were like $28 a piece or something. And she gave them all free. That was an amazing moment for so many of my students, but it really lit that fire within me again to see the power of poetry, what poetry can really do in a situation that other art forms can't really do. I ended up winning Teacher of the Year, and then I won Teacher of the Year out of 85,000 teachers, and then I retired. And over the course of a few years, I had to follow that dream. I had to chase that poetry dream for myself. And Sandra wrote the blurb on my first collection, Periscope Heart. She wrote a blurb for the back of it. So she really brought me back to poetry and allowed me to really see that I had my path, both as a teacher, but also as a poet myself. And now, fast forward 15 years or so, I'm here in Arkansas. I won the Governor's Arts Award for education because I get to teach poetry to 3,500 kids a year now. I visit K through 12 schools and I just drop in and do these little residencies and just teach poetry. Like, poetry is a safe place for your feelings. Tell me what's going on. Yeah. I give them that permission and it's like a little switch goes on. They have a tool now that they can use forever, a tool that I wish I would have had when I was their age.
That is so heartening for me to hear, Kai. I've been an English teacher as well. Never had quite an experience quite like that, but you know, a number of those things where you're reminded and re-reminded what poetry can do. Sometimes I forget. I forget that not everyone has access to it, let alone access to it every day. It's like living in the middle of a big freshwater lake, and then you find out, hey, there's some people who don't even know what water is.
Yeah, that's so true. We swim in it every day. We have poets and poet friends and, you know, all of us, we know poetry, we live poetry. But then you ask any other adult, a lot of these teachers, then I go into their classroom and they're scared to teach poetry because the only experiences they've had were with those same dead old white guys, so they couldn't connect to when they were kids. So it's like the cycle continues. And I go in there and I break that cycle. I bring in poets of color, poets that are alive and writing today that actually have meaning to what's going on in these kids' lives. It makes all the difference. I know that there are a lot of educators now that are doing that, especially in the last 5 or 10 years, really intentionally bringing in diverse voices.
So I'm going to pivot us a little bit. One of the things I thought about while reading your work is it feels as though so often you're a poet of repetition, of returning and revision. I really like this idea, the notions of linear logic. So I really dig it for that. But the other thing I say to my students about repetition is that it shows your obsessions. If you could just talk about that a little bit, how that helps you on the page and just kind of craft wise.
Repetition is one of the legs that I heavily lean on, and also musicality and lyricism in my work, and, you know, using sonic devices. And I just want to be upfront and transparent. I do not have an MFA. I do not, you know, I didn't go to school and learn all these craft things. I just took a few poetry classes at Texas A&M while I was swimming in the waters of trauma of the Corps of Cadets. But poetry for me comes very naturally. And that cyclical nature of my poems, the repetition in the stanzas and that stuff, it's almost ancestral. I don't think about it. It just happens that way. And I don't work a poem to death. I hardly even revise. When a poem is ready, it comes out. I'll marinate on a poem for weeks. I'll have an image and then it gets locked in my head. And I know that something will come from this, and it just kind of marinates in there. That repetition probably is a mirror of how much energy I've given that image, just this constant breathing life into whatever that image is. I know in Makeshift Memorial, a lot of my use of repetition in that poem was for breathing, you know, to breathe, full of breath, because a lot of COVID and the pandemic, that's what it came down to, being on a ventilator, losing your breath. And a lot of times, of course. Yes, that's right. Absolutely. Yeah, the next day, I can't breathe. Thank you for mentioning that. I was very intentional in this book. I wanted to be a scribe. I was an earnest scribe for this moment. This was an important moment in our human history, in our human collective consciousness, and I wanted to document it. Also, it was just my way of surviving and getting through it, of trying to balance the beauty of and nature of my inner world against the chaos and darkness of the outer world, with the protests, with the pandemic, with the freaking election. Oh my God, with the craziness of the last administration. A lot of my work leans into justice work. A lot of work of my work is very political, strongly, strongly political. And so sometimes when I'm writing, that repetition helps me catch my breath. It's a meditation in words, you know? And so those cycles, that repetition, that's the music that I really lean into in my work. It just, it helps me because it's less intellectual and more spiritual when I write.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect segue into one of the questions I've been carrying around since I read the book. Were all of these poems, I mean, so many of them very consciously are referencing the pandemic. And I wanted to know if you began this project setting out to sort of document what was going on, or was that just happenstance that all of these came together? And were there any poems in the collection that were written prior to the pandemic that you wanted to include as you were collating it all?
It happened naturally. I didn't go into like, okay, there's a pandemic, I'm going to write about it, you know. another one of my hats is as the host of Wednesday Night Poetry, the longest running consecutive weekly open mic series in the entire country. And so we were meeting in person and then everything got shut down. And I moved it to Facebook virtually, like, hey, local poets, send me a video of yourself reading a poem and I will post it at the same time that we usually have our coffee shop meetings so that we don't break our streak. It's 1,698 weeks in a row now. We've never missed a Wednesday since February 1st, 1989.
Can we just pause to give
that part.
Fingers that to that?
Part.
Like,
that yeah. part, that part, so, yes, yes.
You know, I was made the host a couple years ago, and the founder was like, I want you to take this into the future. Take Wednesday Night Poetry into the future. And I didn't know the future meant a freaking pandemic, you know, like I didn't know right. all that we were going to go through, but damn it, if that streak was going to be broken on my watch. So it turned into this virtual Wednesday Night Poetry. I was writing, but I was writing so that I would have a poem to share on my introduction every week for Wednesday Night Poetry. So that weekly call to write something, it's how this book was born. And so the first poem in this book is the first day of lockdown. And it was the first time that I had to read about what was going on. And it was just me processing it in the moment. And then, so that's why there's this real chronological sense. It's like a journal. It's like you said, stepping into a time machine. That was really my purpose of this book. When I got to the other side of it, I had a publisher waiting in December. And I was like, it's not done yet. And I just knew. And it started getting a resolution after the inauguration. A little bit of hope now. Like we can lean it. Maybe we're coming out of this dark tunnel. I wasn't going to leave my readers in the dark. So I had to get to the other side. And unfortunately, it's like the tunnel is doubling now. And I think it's important to look back on where we've been in that year of 2020 so that we can try to not repeat some of the mistakes in the years to come, because we're still so entrenched in this pandemic. A couple of the poems in the book I did right before the pandemic, the one about my dogs, Temple Dogs. And there's a poem about my mom also that I stuck toward the end because her name is Esther. But in Tagalog, in the Philippines, her name is Estrelita, which means little star, and mining for stardust. I just had to throw that in there.
And I love what you said, thinking about repetition as being ancestral. One of the things piggybacking off of that is you were talking about, you know, making formal decisions with breath. So I was looking at your poems on the page in your book and of the published poems, all these irregular line lengths and all these irregular stanza formations. So I was just wondering, is the breath a defining feature when you make a line breaks, or how are you kind of making those decisions? I know you say you don't overwork a poem, but at the same time, I know all of us poets are making purposeful lineation decisions. So I just wonder what were kind of your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. When I write a poem, I say it out loud while I'm writing it. And if it doesn't sound right, if there isn't the right amount of syllables to hear that internal rhyme or that play on words and it doesn't fit correctly, then I'll change it. Then I'll lengthen the lines. When I was a novice poet in my first book, I was like, well, what's a line break? What do we do that for? And I was just writing just to write, you know, but now mm-hmm. that I've studied and read and I understand that, you know, the power of enjambment to mm-hmm. give these double meanings and everything is, you know, I use that as well. But really, it's just how it sounds when it's coming out of my mouth. I want that to be reflected onto the page. I'm more comfortable sort of with the shorter line lengths, but if it doesn't sound right, if the reflections of sound don't convey the energy correctly, then I'll keep on working it and keep on changing it.
Yeah, because what you're telling me, at least what I heard, is like not only do you make it by breath and by sound, but also by meaning making with the enjambment, yes, trying to get the kind of double right. play. And I think what I was really interested in, though, is just how often you'll play like the long line and then the real short line. And so we get this call and response feel that also feels very ancestral.
Yeah, so exactly. The oral tradition. I mean, we relied on the oral tradition for so long for storytelling. And it's cool to subtly use that repetition to remember, to call back, to enhance. And so it's a beautiful thing to be aware of and to use.
We'll get back to that interview in a moment. If you enjoy this podcast and want to learn more about us, log on to thepoetrysalon.com.
Most writers need a community around them to sustain their motivation and excitement for writing. The mission of the Poetry Salon is to provide inspiration, education, and support for poets everywhere at a price that is affordable.
Together, we are building a thriving community through online classes, e-courses, and readings, so you have the tools to live the life of a growing, prolific, accountable writer.
You also get opportunities to share your work and receive supportive feedback, then turn your finished pieces into journal submissions, building an audience for your writing.
Again, visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today.
My immediate thought reading your collection was, this is kind of modern day Wordsworth, but also I felt the influence of Joy Harjo, especially with that repetition. She's an amazing performance poet. And she also does the part where she'll repeat three things in a row. Like, she's got this great poem I love, Fear. She's like, Fear, you can't live in my heart anymore. Fear, my heart, my heart, my heart. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that very often.
Wow, thank you so much. And that's such an honor to be compared even slightly to Joy Harjo. She's one of my influences, and Naomi Shihab Nye, Mary Oliver, Jane Hirschfield. These are my giants. And I love Ada Limón as a contemporary and Jericho Brown, mm-hmm. of course. But those women, these are poets that are more accessible to anybody, you know? And that's the kind of poet that I want to be. I don't want to be a poet that just anybody can't pick up my book and understand it and feel it. I'm driven by feeling. I'm driven by heart. It's not an intellectual practice for me to write a poem. I want someone to feel something when they read my work. I want it to just penetrate their, just like get chills. Like Doug, you said you got chills earlier, you know, and that's the kind of feeling that I want, to be moved by spirit and to be moved by beauty. There's so much poetry out there that's reflecting so much trauma and darkness and survival and, you know, sexual assault and all of these things. And that's very, very important. But what I want to do is I always want to leave light. I want to mm-hmm. give hope and light, no matter what we're going through. And I don't shy away from the ugliness of humanity, because there is a lot of it. But I can't leave myself there. I can't leave mm-hmm. my reader there. So there's always going to be some semblance of hope, some semblance of beauty or light, or for me to share the nature that I have around me. Mm-hmm. Even though it's not expensive to live in Arkansas, the place that I live in is priceless. To be surrounded by all of this wildlife and beauty and flowers and trees, people in the city don't get that. And Tricia, you there in the tropics, you know, the life mm-hmm. you live, mm-hmm. people don't get to see that every day. You know, we are very lucky to be surrounded and healed by nature, when so much of the world is in this concrete jungle with all this energy and technology and traffic and all this stuff around. And so it's always imbued with nature, with birds, with those elements that are healing, not just for me, but could possibly heal someone that might read or stumble across one of my poems.
Kai, one of the things hearing you talk about nature is thinking about writers of color who are reclaiming the notion. Poets like Camille Dungy has that whole collection of Black nature poets and stuff like that. So often minoritized bodies have ended up in these cities. We were so connected to the earth. And, you know, Camille talks about that, also shows that. And I think it's really important to kind of reclaim that.
So much of my family is still so connected to the land. I have family in the Philippines that are literally farming rice today, right now, riding water buffalo. It's just, it's neat to be able to tap into that and to bring that to the surface. But also here, my wife has made our home a wildlife sanctuary. I mean, she's a master naturalist. And so like everything we do is for the birds and the animals and the trees and everything around us. I can't help but write about that stuff. I mean, it's happening all around me. I want to just share it with a hummingbird came and sat on my finger or whatever, you know, it's just, it doesn't happen.
You said that you always want your poems to come to light and to bring us back to a sense of light. So I wanted to ask, where did that come from? And can we get some on eBay? And can I order that?
Well, you've got it within you. It's called your soul. Coming into knowing not just your bodies and your mundane earthly experience. A lot of people don't write about metaphysical things. When I met my wife, you know, I kind of got really introduced to this whole other world and way of living. In the world, but not of the world, seeing and experiencing the world, but not having to like be weighted down by all the gravity of it and all the pain of it. And of course, as a poet, we feel so deeply. We feel everything. We see everything. And we see even closer because we're poets. We observe so acutely and so sharply. And when we see children in cages, seeing these things and being such a sensitive person, I really tried to use my poems as a source of light. My book, Incandescent, I wrote this when Trump was getting elected and there was just so much darkness. I was using my poems to fight. These were my weapons. My poems were weapons of light in so much darkness. And in the 4 years that were about to just take us into this hell that we're still coming out of, my poems were an intentional weapon of light.
What a turn of phrase. To throw you for another question though is, you talk about being a warrior poet, and so can you just talk about your weapons of light, talk about being a poet of witness, talk about being a warrior poet and what that means and how you can inspire other people to do that?
Okay, well, going into Wednesday Night Poetry, and remember I said earlier, it's almost like my soul made this agreement with my body that we're going to go into the trenches. Get ready, buckle up, Buttercup, because it's going to get bad. So personally, for me, I went into these really dark, backwards spots, like being in the Corps, being in the military, having to be gay and also be Catholic. And I played Jesus on a cross. I was crucified on a cross in front of 2,000 Catholic high school kids. And I was like, oh my God, I'm a lesbian. I'm getting crucified. It was a play. It was a skit. But like that turned into a poem. When I moved here to Arkansas, again, that was another, let's get into the trenches. I mean, it's a beautiful state. There's beautiful people here, of course, but let's be real. Coming here in the midst of the Trump administration and in the midst of being an out queer woman, but going to these open mics at Wednesday Night Poetry and talking about gun violence and talking about the Pulse Massacre and talking about all these things and reading these poems on that open mic, all of a sudden it was like, wow, this is power. This is how I'm fighting. This is how I'm saving the world. Because sometimes I'm reading to a room at a coffee shop, but it feels like these poems are vibrating and reverberating out to who knows where. Who knows where energy does not stop. They go into the hearts of these people and then those people go into their communities and it just kind of keeps on rippling out. So I wrote a poem that was nominated for a pushcart about these two old white men that sang Dixie at an open mic after the Charleston massacre. There was a Black church that was burned down and they sang Dixie at the open mic. And it's like, you don't understand how it wasn't an intentional act of racism. It was just ignorance is bliss or whatever, but
they never had to care.
They didn't have to care, but like, you don't even see how crazy harmful that is in this particular moment right now. So me reading a poem about that situation and I changed the words to Dixie and like, it's a pretty good poem, honestly, I'm pretty proud of it, but things like that, that can bring awareness, that can change people's minds. When good people, people that are conscious, people that care about humanity, when they see something and they don't have the words for it, they know they're just pissed off. They know that they're angry about this injustice. Having the ability to put something into words that can voice their disdain for the situation is something that I do not take lightly. Mm-hmm. I pick up this weapon of light and I use it carefully and I wield it carefully through these poems. And with Mining for Stardust and with Incandescent especially, I knew that this was a tumultuous, tumultuous time. And poets, you know, they don't give themselves enough credit to be like, I'm standing up and this is how I am helping mm-hmm. humanity. I'm going to write mm-hmm. these poems. I'm going to write about these kids in the cages. I'm, you know, and it's mm-hmm. like that I am a warrior poet, but I'm also a nature poet, but I'm also a spirit poet. Like, I don't fit into a box. I'm like water. I'll just go wherever it needs. I'll go to that lowest point and I'll write a poem about it and bring it to the consciousness of whoever might be listening. And so that's how I'm working it right now, Doug. Thank you for these awesome questions.
Awesome, awesome. No, homie, and also my partner and I are together for 12 years and we just got married in June. Oh, so like same kind of thing. Like we're like, yeah. We waited for it forever too. So
I want to ask a half real person, half poetry question, which is, Kay, mm-hmm. you have this great poem about using the word wife over and over again. Are you like going around having a lot of fun saying wife?
It does feel, it's just a new settling, you know, like it's different to be in a relationship with somebody for such a long time, but then like wife, like yeah. this is my wife. And even that, just to say that it's in my bio and mm-hmm. I live in Arkansas, being that out, it saves children. It saves the kids. Mm-hmm. I'm on Zoom all the time. Right. And I have this trans flag behind me, trans youth. You are not alone, because here in Arkansas, they're doing everything they can to get these trans kids to kill themselves, basically, yep. not giving them health care. They can't even be. And so to have an adult that's out in the community, that's well-known in the state, that's just out and proud and being myself, it gives mm-hmm. other people permission to be themselves too. Like, look, she's out, she's successful. She's winning these mm-hmm. awards and whatever, mm-hmm. you know, and she's in Arkansas. So that's another one of those things. I came into these trenches and it's like, hey, I'm here. You're not alone. You don't have to die here. There's a way out. There's other worlds. I feel like that's what we all do. All of us that are teaching, that are here for humanity, that are here to help. I recognize it within both of you. It's just who we are. We've got to keep doing it.
Yeah. And I think that's so important because, of course, sometimes people, I think, can say, well, poetry is a luxury, or you can feel like, hey, poetry is a luxury. I'm not doing my part. And yet at the same time, Shelley says that poets
legislators of the world.
Yeah, we're the unacknowledged legislators of the world. You can't discount that to just live your life in dignity and honesty and make a little record of it and send that out to the world. That does have an impact, and it's an invisible impact. You can't bottle it. You can't sell it at Nordstrom's. So it kind of gets discounted a lot of the time, and you have to be constantly reminding yourself and reminding others, no, this actually does matter.
You can't really put a number on it. You can't weigh it in terms of like financial things. You can't add it up, the work that we're doing, you know, as poets. But I don't measure on that scale. I don't measure in earthly ways, and I don't measure in capitalism. I'm not a millionaire off these books by any means. I'm barely a thousandaire, but this work is a record and it is energy. Art is energy. Yeah. And in the times of darkness, humanity turns to the poets, turns to the musicians, the singers, the songwriters, the paintings, to remember who we are and what moves us forward. They don't turn to politics and sports, whatever. It's art. It's art. Yeah. And so, especially with Incandescent, my last book from Sibling Rivalry Press, they have a contract with the Library of Congress. And every collection that they publish goes into the special and rare collection vault of the Library of Congress. And so for me, as a poet, writing these fierce anti-Trump poems, that book went into a rare and special collections vault of the Library of Congress. That's progress. That's fighting for life.
That's canon reformation. That's putting our names into the canon.
This is exactly, Doug. It's putting our names into the canon. It's reclaiming, it's telling our stories, it's pulling all of our histories up and saying, this is us and we are here and we are loud and we are doing it, we are writing it. It's vibrations, it's energy, it's reaching people's hearts. That's all I care about.
I do want to talk a little bit more about craft. I wanted to ask about the poem that came easiest to you. If you could speak a little bit about the way that poems come to you and the way that you allow them to come to you, and about this one specifically, the wife poem.
Okay, that was the easiest just because I was so joyful to write that poem about my wife. Again, when a poem comes to me, it's almost like I go into this omniscient space. Like I'll like go out of my body and see what's going on when something is unfolding in such a beautiful way, or in a way that I know I'm the only one noticing this right now. For me, that happens a lot. Like, I know I'm the only one seeing this right now. And then time freezes. I make this moment holy by really looking at it and really noticing it, saving that image, saving those colors or those sounds or that feeling. And again, I bring it into myself and it sort of marinates there for a little while. Or I'll have a line that just comes to me and I'll work it in my head. And then finally, when I sit down, it just pours out. I've said this before, but even in my earlier works, if you just open yourself up without ego and you just open yourself to like the collective energy of art and what poetry can be, then things can just come. Things can just flow. You know, you get into the flow, and people call it the muses, they call it whatever, but it's letting go of yourself, you know, these bodies that we wear, as Doug loves to say, and tapping into this higher self that's seeing everything and that can comment on everything and that is searching for beauty or truth or light or whatever those things are. The universe works in harmony with those things. And so if you're a champion for those things, if you're a warrior for those things, it's going to help you to put that out there. Like I said, I don't sit and agonize over a word or a line or edit. And that's just my writing process. I've tried to do it that way. And usually I'll just like distill it to death, that it loses its purity. Sometimes there's just a purity that comes in this shoot of inspiration. And if I try to over intellectualize it, that energy dissipates. Unless there's like a glaring misspelled word. I have a really trusty copy editor that comes and reads all my books before I send them. And he's like, did you really mean to say this? And what, you know, I before eat, no. But so that's most of the editing that I do, is I really try to keep the energy pure. Whether one person reads it or a million people read it, that energy stays the same. So that's my process. It's more of almost a spiritual practice for me, a meditation. And you said it was like reading almost a diary or a journal. And if I look back on 2020, you know, the lockdown started in the middle of March. And then in April, every year, I do the 30-30 challenge for National Poetry Writing Month. You know, so I was literally trying to write a poem a day in April. And so it was like 2 weeks into the pandemic. And here I am on social media, sharing a poem a day, getting other people to write with me. So it literally was at some points a daily reflection about what was going on and how this pandemic was unfolding in these early days. And then the poems got a little more farther apart, and it's like 10,000 are dead. Okay, now 85,000 are dead. Now 100,000 are dead. The scope of it got larger because our problems, it got really, really dark there. There's a poem in the book about finding 2020 glasses from New Year's. And I look back on the whole year in one poem. And that was also a really hard poem to write, starting with Kobe Bryant dying in that helicopter crash, and then the whole year in one poem. That was another conscious thing that I really tried to do, because that was the moment that was like, oh my God, the 2020 glasses just fell down out of the art cabinet. And I was like, ah, what if we could look back through these the
metaphors right
goggles.
There. That was such a
I know,
gift
that's
for
what
poem.
I mean.
That's
like,
so
it just,
powerful.
Boom.
So powerful.
How do I not write about this? The tumbling out of the art closet, these shiny 2020 glasses. I put them on and like, what do I see? What we saw this year shape how we treat each other in 2021. in the rest of our lives? How does what we've just been through, we can't just forget it, push it under the rug. Yeah, we survived a global pandemic. Okay, now what next? We go back to work, we go back to life as it was? No. And that's why another reason I need this book out, and I need it out now. I needed it to be put out this year because it's vital. It's current. Wow. I couldn't wait till 2024 or whatever. Mm-hmm. This energy is still brewing. In Arkansas, there were 3,000 new cases yesterday. So I need the energy of these poems to come back and recycle again. And maybe we can read something and change our behavior. And so there's a lot of high hopes I have for the intention of this book. And I really appreciate you, Douglas and Tricia, for giving me the space to verbalize it.
It was so awesome to discover your work through Tricia and everything. Mm. Seriously, thank you so much.
Thank you for the work that you do as a teacher, as a professor, everything you do in the world. It was an honor to meet you, Doug.
And Kay, I love seeing your photos on Facebook. We'll continue to be in touch in other places.
Like the sky. Okay, love y'all. Be safe. All right, bye.
Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Tricia at thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Tricia at thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!